from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, after San Francisco Police Chief George Gascon was named District Attorney of San Francisco, Jeff Godown was named the city's interim chief of police, and he'll join us in studio for the hour to discuss a range of issues, including a police commission meeting today that will take up the whole question of police treatment of the mentally ill. We'll talk about the use of laid tasers with them. We'll talk about community policing and foot patrols, enforcing sit-lie, and much more, all next on Forum. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 29-year Los Angeles Police Department veteran Jeff Godown came to San Francisco 14 months ago to work with Police Chief George Gascon, who chose his fellow colleague when Chief Gascon served in L.A. to join him in San Francisco. And now, following Chief Gascon's appointment to replace newly elected California Attorney General Kamala Harris as San Francisco's district attorney, Jeff Godown was named interim San Francisco Police Chief. Known for his hard work and no-nonsense ethic and his claim that what he seeks above all is to make people accountable for what they do, Jeff Godown joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour. Chief, good to have you here. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I thought we'd talk first about what's going to be a matter before the police commission this evening. The seven-member police commission was supposed to be talking about tasers, but they shifted their agenda, and we'll talk about tasers, certainly. But talking about dealing with the mentally ill, because there have been a couple of incidents particularly that's brought that to the fore, and the training program was suspended last summer. It's going to be revamped, and you hope it'll be revamped in what way?
We hope to revamp it. The training program that was implemented prior to our arrival was funded, and that funding ran out. And when we looked at that training program, it was a 40-hour class, and the training program for a 40-hour class cost the San Francisco Police Department around $40,000 for a 40-hour training. When we ran out of the funding, my direction was to take the training back to the police academy, continue the quality of the training, but condense it in a way that it wouldn't cost us as much money. And now we have the class down to about $5,000. And that training will be re-implemented back in the end of February as far as the mental illness training is concerned. All the officers, most of them in the patrol aspect who I need to get in through the training first, the 40-hour training, will go back through that training.
Memphis has a program that's been sort of exemplary in this way, hasn't it? They use a team, in fact.
Memphis has what is called a CIT team. I personally went back to Los Angeles, and we sent some folks back to Memphis to look at best practices. And these two police departments in reference to a CIT team where there are a smaller group of officers that are specially trained in mental illness and are able to respond to the mental illness calls and handle them in a more proficient manner. So tonight at the police commission, we're going to be discussing some hybrid approach to something in reference to parts of Los Angeles, parts of what we're doing here in San Francisco, and parts of Memphis PD to put together a more comprehensive plan on how we're going to handle the issues.
Well, I mentioned earlier that tasers was supposed to be on tap to be discussed this evening, but is going to be on an agenda later on. There was a battle with the police commission over the use of tasers, and it's a different police commission now, but what are you anticipating, well, particularly in terms of, I mean, the idea of using it as an additional law enforcement tool? First of all, I think maybe listeners would like to hear why it's important to use.
The taser is one more tool in the toolbox that I think the officers need to do their job more effectively. I think the misconception, a taser is a less lethal weapon. It is not a non-lethal weapon, meaning there have been incidents where people have died because of the use of tasers. What I want to do is to research the feasibility of deploying the tasers in the city of San Francisco, plus look at other options that we could possibly put in the toolbox. In 2 weeks, I'll go back to the police commission. And all I'm asking for is permission to now go back and look at the feasibility of implementing tasers, the cost, how we would implement them, how the training would occur, to bring back public comment, and then again bring it back to the police commission for a vote. So this first go-around is just permission to go research the feasibilities of implementing tasers. It is not to give us permission to arm our officers with tasers.
Concern about safety and liability with tasers. Big concerns.
there are big concerns, and I serve this community, and there are when I go out in the community, some people are okay with the use of tasers, and some people aren't. And again, at the end of the day, I am employed here, and I serve this community, and if the community tells me that they don't want tasers, then we won't have tasers.
Most big cities have taser use for police.
Correct. Most big cities do use tasers. In fact, I think the San Francisco Sheriff's Department today have tasers.
Well, of course, there's this new thing that the taser, as soon as it's taken out of the holster, sends off pretty audible sounds, does it not?
It depends on what kind of style of taser you use. Taser is the term everybody uses. It's kind of like the term Xerox. It's a verb.
It's a stun gun,
it's
really.
It's a stun gun.
Yeah.
There's different styles of it. The taser gun itself has morphed, you know, year after year after year, and has become a better weapon. Again, we're going to start researching the feasibility, what type of weapon. I plan on bringing some of the community stakeholders on board during this process, if, in fact, I do get permission to look at them, to have them with me, allow them to shoot it, allow them to go through the training, and get a true understanding as to what the taser is really all about.
Talking with Acting Police Chief Jeff Godown, what about the ruling? Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals back in December ruled that the police must have reason for using a taser, reasonable grounds for using a taser. And here in San Francisco, there was a court ruling as well down in Southern California that had to do with a Southern California officer exercising force, which was considered unnecessary in just a traffic stop. I mean, these kind of court cases make it difficult, make it even more complex, it seems.
It definitely does. When we look at the implementation of tasers and we go out and research that process, and I have some people from the community come up to me and tell me they want us to have nothing to do with tasers, and then they cite some YouTube video or something that's on CNN where a state trooper tases a pregnant lady or a small child, it's hard to defend that. And obviously, it's not the weapon that's causing the problem. It's the person that is using that weapon. So those are the issues that we're going to have to deal with. They have to be highly trained. Every situation is not a situation where a taser can be used. And it's going to take a significant amount of training to make sure that I feel comfortable that we can implement this process where it's going to be safe for everyone.
That routine traffic stop back in 2005 was for not wearing a seatbelt, by the way, just for the record. You want this job permanently?
You know what? I've talked to my wife about that. I have a 9-year-old daughter. I love this department. I want to stay on this department in some capacity. And if asked to stay on as the chief of police, I would.
Well, we should mention just a little bit as far as Bonafides, besides serving 29 years, including your first boss being Daryl Gates. You came here and you ran the CompStat computerized crime tracking system and also oversaw the crime lab in Hunter's Point, which was pretty scandal-ridden. But yet you're still viewed as an outsider. And there are people who say, I mean, everybody here who's met you thinks you're a pretty good guy, but you have this reputation as a hammer, as a tough guy, as a bad cop, in fact, as they say. You're the bad cop. George was a good cop.
You know, my philosophy on that, if calling me a bad cop is holding the people accountable for which I know the community wants me to do, then I'll take that title. I'm good with that. All I ask officers to do is come in, treat the community with respect, do their job, service the community, and they're not going to have issues with me. When they deter from that and don't do what they're supposed to do, then they're going to have issues with me. I'm holding them accountable. That's why I was brought here in the first place, and I'm going to continue to hold the members of this department accountable.
Where I come from, they call that old school, of course. But you also made a statement, I believe, to the press. I think I have it accurately. You said when you were in Los Angeles, you'd smash your fist down and you get something done. You come to San Francisco, smash your fist down and you get a sore hand. Why is it so much more? I'm glad I got a smile out of you. That'll break that spell or stereotype of you being the tough guy. But why is it so much tougher here?
I think I come from a background where process cannot overload the product, meaning the process cannot overwhelm the ultimate goal in which you want to get to. Sometimes process has to take a process. In some instances, there is a process that we have to go through. Every day I learn a little more about this department. I learn a little more about the people on this department. This is a very rich department. It's a very small. I came from an environment that was 482 square miles with 10,000 police officers to 49 square miles with about 2,000 police officers. So I do learn a little more about the history and culture here. One of the advantages I think I have over most of the officers on this department is I came from a department that had an outsider. William Bratton came in. So we had a rich history in LAPD of Daryl Gates and working their way through the process, and all of a sudden this guy shows up with this weird Bostonian accent, and he wanted to change uniforms, and he wanted to change the way we did things. And it took a couple years to realize that that outside thinking process is very beneficial. In some instances, what I get here is when I ask, why do we do it this way? The response I get is, well, that's just the way we've always done it.
So you got to win over the rank and file, don't you?
I do. And I think to a certain extent, I'll give you an example. The other day I walked out of the elevator by myself and there was a young officer in the elevator. I think he worked narcotics. And during the departure of Chief, now DA Gascon, and me put in this position, he turned to me and I don't even know this kid. And he turned to me and said, I hope you stay. And that meant a lot to me to get that from somebody from the rank and file, because the reality is those are the men and women that get in the black and whites. They answer the radio calls. They work at the wee hours in the morning. They're out there dealing with the 911 calls. They're out there dealing with the issues in the city. And it meant a lot to me to get that from somebody that had no, he didn't have to turn around and say anything to me.
We had the chief of police, San Jose chief of police on just last week, in fact, and talking about with budget cuts and everything, the morale problem among the rank and file. I mean, it's serious, isn't it?
It is. And the budget cuts here in the city are very significant based on my requirement to give the city back 10% of my budget. There is the potential that if, in fact, I give back the remainder of the 10% I owe, that we would not have any more academy classes for fiscal 2011-2012. Which puts a significant burden on the rank and file because we average between 5 and 7 people retiring each month, and I can't backfill those positions, meaning I have less officers on the street. I've got to start looking at the admin, and I've got to start figuring out how many people I need inside the Hall of Justice to support. There needs to be an admin function to be able to support the patrol and investigations, and I'm trying to put as many people as I can back out in the field, but it is a balancing act for me to keep the rank and file motivated. Old police cars, old police buildings, the infrastructure is very old, so it is a balancing act to figure out how we're going to continue to field officers, plus handle the fiscal crisis that everybody's dealing with. And it's not only in San Francisco, San Jose, everywhere
it's
in the country.
Yeah.
Everywhere in the country has the same problem.
Talking again with Acting Police Chief Jeff Godin, you've said that your priority is filling these police academy classes. At least it's one of your priorities.
Correct. I mean, we have to have some academy classes. The retirement rate, and as people leave, we have to backfill these positions. If we don't, we're going to lose more patrol officers, which means when 911 calls come out, it's going to take longer to respond. Investigations could take longer to complete. We need more people in this department.
You also said that one of your top priorities is a security plan for the America Cup sailing races. What do you envision there? What are you seeing at this point?
Well, right now we're in the preliminary stages. We have a commander that's assigned to an America's Cup team from the SFPD, and they're going to some of the locations. In fact, I think they're in Miami this week looking at some best practices. But it's going to be a great event. I remember when the America's Cup, I think they had it in San Diego. It was a great event. It's going to take a lot of security, and it's going to take a lot of planning ahead of time, but I think it'll be a great event here in the city.
What about community policing? I know recently you met with Supervisor Mercurimi and talked about having more foot patrols, this sort of thing, and yet, it's been voted down. Where do you stand?
I think the definition of community policing, if you were to ask the 5 or 6 ladies sitting in the room next to us, everybody would have their own definition of what community policing is. The fact that we interact with the community is technically community policing. It might not be the best way to do it, but the community has to be more involved. If you go back and look at the criminology books dated over 100 years ago, Robert Peel, they talk about the fact that the entity that is actually responsible for safety in the community is the community itself. And we need to work closer with the community. There needs to be more community input. We had a community meeting with Supervisor Mercurimi, I think, a couple nights ago. And they talked about some of the issues with the SFPD. And I think the communication back to the community is what we're lacking. We have to spend a little more time talking to the community stakeholders about issues. Footbeats, for example. I know that ballot initiative was voted down. We have footbeats. We invest about 20 hours each day in each district in footbeats. The issue with footbeats is, do I have enough bodies to continue to put footbeats in areas where I can't afford to put officers on foot. I know in community policing, the foot beats are the best way to go. They get a chance to talk to the community. They get a chance to go into the business owners, and there's more of a person walking up and down the street, a human being, so to speak. There's more than just the uniform they're wearing. So there has to be an even balance for me. I'm not against foot beats. We still have a lot of foot beats. I'd love to have more foot beats. But in 2011, like everything else in society, everything's driven by an automobile. We go from one radio call to another radio call. So I think one of the big issues with communication as far as community policing is that we had one district where we had to move a foot beat. We could not afford to keep the foot beat at a certain location, and the captain pulled that foot beat out and put him back in a car. We didn't do a very good job of letting the community know ahead of time as to what we were doing. And I think with the budget crisis and how we're tweaking our deployment plan, we've got to reach out more to the community stakeholders and get them involved in the beginning, where they don't realize at the end, after we've done something, I've got to get them involved in the front end of some of these discussions.
Speaking about getting the community involved, I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. If you have a question for Chief Godown, or if you have something you'd like to bring into the conversation here, we welcome your calls, and you can reach us now at our toll-free number, wherever you're listening to us, or however, on the internet, on Sirius Satellite, or on the radio. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, and please feel free to join us now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also direct questions or comments to the Chief by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or by posting your questions or comments on the web, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. I've been talking about training officers to do better work in terms of building up trust with the community, obviously, from your last remarks, training officers to do better work with the mentally ill. What about sit-lie?
Sit and lie. We're doing an extensive training program for the officers. There'll be an extensive public campaign to alert the public as to what is occurring with the sit and lie. And we have not fully implemented the sit and lie, where we're actually going out and citing people for that particular violation of the ordinance. I want to make sure that everybody understands it, that we have trained all our officers, that we are prepared to go out and implement it in a professional fashion. And if I deem that we're not ready to implement that, we'll take a step back and take a couple weeks to make sure that there's a training process, there's public education, and most importantly, in the beginning phases of sit and lie, there'll be a lot of warnings that are going to be given.
It's also an ongoing problem with gangs in the San Francisco area, and also a recent spike in homicides despite the crime rate being down. Less money, less resources. What are we going to do about it?
Well, I can tell you of the 11 homicides that we've had year-to-date, only one of them so far, the investigation has told us it was gang-related. And some of the other homicides, for example, the one in Fisherman's Wharf turned out to be a dispute between two different proprietors of businesses there. I try to sometimes put context to these homicides to let the general public know that the victims knows the suspect, so they have an understanding, and I try to communicate that more. Have less officers than we did a couple years ago? Yes, but I'm never, ever going to use the excuse that less officers are going to be a reason for crime to go up. I'm still going to be very thoughtful with the deployment of the officers. We're still going to fight crime. I'm comfortable with these 11 homicides, that we don't have any gang-related patterns right now. We've done a very good job of investigating the homicides, and even though crime is down and homicides are up, in most instances, there is a connection between the victim and the suspect on these homicides.
Getting back for a moment, we'll go to our callers here, but to what you alluded to before, the differences between Los Angeles and San Francisco, which are pretty dramatic. Does that mean a bigger learning curve for you as police chief?
I don't think it's a bigger learning curve, but I don't have the luxury of picking up the radio and having 100 officers show up at Turk and Taylor in a 5-minute process like we could in Los Angeles. The volume of calls and the volume of officers made it a luxury that we could move resources around in a matter of minutes here with a smaller department and a dwindling patrol force. I don't have the luxury of being able to. When we lose one or two officers to being sick or injured on duty, it really, really does affect the deployment of each of these districts. So I think the volume of personnel that we had at our disposal in Los Angeles, we don't have that here. So there's got to be a much more thoughtful process in how we utilize the personnel we do have.
How do you feel about personnel living outside, and particularly as they get farther away in the commutes from San Francisco itself?
Historically, across the country, I know in the news last night, the mayor in Detroit was proposing that officers could buy homes inside Detroit for $1,000. The problem is that because of the housing market in most big cities, It's more affordable for officers to live outside the city. I think that in the 80 percentile, the officers in San Francisco live outside the city and they commute into the city.
Imagine we can get to San Francisco for $1,000? Nothing.
Nothing. A parking space maybe
a
for
parking
a month.
Space, yeah.
The problem that we have here is that, quite frankly, when it comes to, you know, in Los Angeles, again, I refer back to my prior experience. We had an officer next door program. Police officers are put in a position to make decisions for people. Police officers are put in decisions to sometimes make decisions that people don't agree with and make arrests. Back in Los Angeles in the early 80s, I worked in a district called North Hollywood. I lived in that district called North Hollywood. There were many instances where I would show up at the grocery store or the laundromat or go to the dry cleaners and somebody would walk through the door who I had arrested a month or two earlier. So it does make it an officer safety issue in some instances. We had an officer next door program where officers in LA could buy property at a much lower rate, and we did have issues where some of the gang members in the community realized there was a police officer that lived there and we had some officer safety issues. So, I mean, that has to come into consideration too.
Let's bring some of our callers in. We go first to Ganesh in Mountain View. Good morning.
Hi. My name is Ganesh. I'm calling from Mountain View. Thank you for having me on. I had a question for the chief about the budget part. So currently, police officers make somewhere north of $100,000 a year, and a police chief makes somewhere north of $300,000 a year and retire after 20 years with a 70% pension. Given that there is an economic crisis going on and that the rest of us, you know, it's hard to find a job. And even if you find a job, you don't get pension benefits for sure nowadays. Do you think you should drop salaries or entitlements to solve the budget issue?
The job salaries fair, I think, is really the pith of the question, particularly with respect to the chief as opposed to the rank and file, maybe.
Well, I know that everybody has issues with the salaries, and I know in the last couple of weeks there have been a lot of print media in reference to pension salaries that people are getting and how much they're getting each month. I do agree in some instances that, you know, most of the salaries or the pay raises that the officers get are contractual that have been signed off by City Hall, and you cannot violate that contract. But I do understand that when someone sees somebody get a pension of $250,000 or $20,000 a month for the rest of their life, that does bring some concern to people that are unemployed.
You also hear people complain about how young many police officers are when they're able to retire. Entitled to retire at a fairly young age, as so the crow flies, so to speak.
If you come on at 21 years old, you can do 29 years and retire at 50. So, yeah, you can retire, I mean, at 50 years old. Law enforcement is a great career. I cannot complain about the benefits that we get on this department, the medical benefits that we get. So I do understand his concern in reference to it. But there's pension reform and things like that that are being looked at to see if we can make a difference there.
Mayor Oakland just took self-decided quarter cut in salary.
Yes, I heard about that this morning.
Want to comment?
No.
Okay, let me go to more calls here. We'll go to Colin in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Chief, your former boss is now the district attorney, and I'm kind of wondering, I realize that there's been a lot of bad blood between the district attorney's office and the police department over the years over such issues as Kamala Harris's refusal to ask for the death penalty for the murderer of Officer Isaac Espinoza. I'm just wondering, though, with your former boss as the DA, is the pendulum swinging too far in the other direction?
It's a good question, Colin. I'm sorry to jump in here, but we're coming up on a break, and I'd like to hear what Chief Godon has to say about this. You work very closely with George Gascon. I mean, that all augurs well.
Yes, I mean, I don't think the pendulum swung the other direction. You know, I think that the district attorney made a comment during his press conference that in some instances he thinks the death penalty is appropriate depending on the cases. He said that to the news media, and I do agree with that also. But I don't think there's going to be a conflict or it's swinging the opposite direction.
Well, when we come back, more of your calls and emails for Chief Jeff Godown. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Acting Police Chief Jeff Godown here on Forum this hour, and you can join us if you have questions or comments. We welcome them. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. He's talking about George Gascon taking over now the DA's office. Even though you've had a close relationship with him for many years, he brought you here to San Francisco. No one was more surprised. I mean, everybody was kind of surprised, including you.
Yes, I was surprised. I received a call Saturday night about 10:30 in reference to the fact that at that time the mayor, Newsom, had discussed with him the possibility of him becoming the district attorney. The next morning at 11:30, I received a call stating he was going to be the district attorney. I then went to a press conference at City Hall at 2 o'clock and have been running at 100 miles an hour ever since.
Here's an email from a listener named Walter who says, graffiti is a $20 million a year problem in the city. What is the strategy of the police department to proactively catch some of the vandals that seem to be able to deface our city without much risk to themselves? Police and patrol cars waiting for a 9/11 call does not seem to be a very effective way to treat this crime.
I agree. I mean, the graffiti issue is an issue that spans across this country, and there are a lot of private entities that will go out and paint over the graffiti as fast as it's put on the wall or the building, excuse me, which I think also does is get rid of the graffiti. There has to be more of a proactive approach with plainclothes officers, possibly utilizing some cameras, but there has to be more of an attention. And remember, when the graffiti is put on the wall, 9 out of 10 times that's related to gang activity, and that graffiti on the wall usually is a message from one gang to another gang, or they're communicating through their graffiti. So those are things that we look at all the time and document them to try to figure out what messages they're sending. So I do agree, graffiti is something that we need to work on. It just is going to have to be a proactive, not a reactive approach.
Well, so inferring correctly, when you were talking about tracing these homicides and only finding one of them possibly gang-related, that you're maybe a lot more optimistic, for lack of a better word, about gang activity here than Los Angeles, which is so notorious and infamous for pretty severe gang activity.
Correct. One of the issues we do have in San Francisco is that most gangs in Los Angeles and across the country, even San Francisco, have certain territories that they stay in. They are well aware of the fact that if they cross into a rival gang territory, there is a possible potential for violence. Unfortunately, what happens here is when some of the venues downtown have hip-hop events or some type of events on Friday or Saturday night, the gang members will congregate down to certain locations in the city where there is not a gang territory. In essence, it becomes neutral territory. That's where we have some of the confrontations when they all come down to downtown for whatever public event they plan on attending. That's where we run into the issues. So the gang activity here, I think we do a really, really good job of looking at gang activity being proactive as far as crime suppression is concerned. But most importantly, when a gang incident occurs or a shooting occurs, we have a lot of officers that are assigned to go out and make sure there isn't any retaliation in reference to that. And I think we do a good job on that.
One area that the police have been criticized for not doing a good enough job is with, aggressive street panhandling and sort of not throwing the book, as some people say, see it, and not doing enough particularly in terms of arrests as well as prosecution. What do you foresee?
Well, I foresee that once we implement the sit and lie or the civil sidewalks initiative, I think that'll help to a certain extent. But I do stay on my officers. I come off the Harrison and Fifth off ramp all the time to come to work, and I'll call the captain at Central and tell them to come out to this off ramp and try to take care of the problem as far as the aggressive panhandling is concerned. No one wants to have someone come up to them and threaten them. And I've had tourists come into town and actually confront me and say, listen, I have no problem. If someone's down on their luck, I have no problem giving money to people that I think need the money, but I just don't want someone to aggressively get up in my face and become argumentative if I don't give them money. So that is an issue, especially around Union Square and some of the other venues. So we, with the footbeats, I mean, this is an example where footbeats become an important tool. We try to get out there and try to deter that from happening.
Our guest again is Interim Police Chief Jeff Godown, and our next caller is AJ. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was just kind of relating to the issue of police safety. I was just wondering the chief's opinion on officers carrying weapons on them kind of concealed when they're off-duty. There was recently an issue here in Marin County where an off-duty Santa Fe police officer is being charged with felony assault for an incident he had off-duty when he was out with his family.
Off-duty, if I remember correctly, the president signed a bill a couple years ago which allows law enforcement officers to carry a weapon anywhere in the United States. You know, certain states have certain requirements that prohibit you carrying a weapon off-duty if you're law enforcement.
This officer, I know the case the caller is talking about, got apparently carried away in an altercation and pulled a gun on someone.
Again, we go back to that issue that we have to be very, very careful. A law enforcement officer is put into a position in this country where we are allowed to make decisions and take freedom away from people at any given moment. There is no one else in a position that can do that. We're given firearms. We're trained in the firearms. It is a huge responsibility. In some instances, that responsibility, in some cases, the officers don't do what's right. And that is a huge responsibility. Off-duty, especially when it comes to alcohol and firearms, becomes an issue. I can tell you that off-duty, most of the time, I will not carry a gun unless I'm with my wife or my daughter and we're going somewhere where I think there's an issue where I have to ask myself why I'm going there in the first place. But I try not to carry a firearm. Especially here in California, it's sunny all the time. People are wearing tank tops and shorts. It's much more difficult to conceal that weapon. But you have to be careful when you've got an off-duty weapon that you're not going to run into a problem.
I hate to break the news to you, Chief. It's not sunny all the time in San Francisco.
I've noticed that.
There is a sense, though, that in two incidents at least, we get back to the whole question of deploying and treating the mentally ill right, where officers use guns and questionable circumstances, whether they should have used the guns, whether they should have shot these people because they were clearly mentally ill. Again, this is going to be taken up tonight, and I know it's going to be discussed in front of the police commission, but isn't there just simply a better way of making officers more responsible in terms of using their weapons and feeling perhaps not necessarily so obliged to use a weapon?
I think it's going to be there's going to be a lot more training. I know in the next year I would like to implement some refresher training as far as tactics are concerned and do a lot more training when it comes to that, because I know that's going to be a big issue over the two issues, the shooting that occurred in Bayview and then the one shooting involving the gentleman in the wheelchair that everybody has seen on YouTube. Those are two issues that I'm looking at quite closely to look at the tactics to make sure that we did everything that we could do to prohibit having to use deadly force, because I will tell you there was an issue in Bayview, and I think you're talking about the issue with the young man with the that the officers entered the location. They were confronted with somebody that had a sharp-edged weapon. I can tell you that his mother at the location was a sweet lady. Her husband sat downstairs in the garage. I was informed a half hour after I got there that the suspect in question had died at the hospital. There was a language issue with the mother. I waited for someone to show up that spoke Cantonese, and I personally, through that interpreter, had to tell his mother that her son had passed away. And it was a heart-wrenching, even though I feel bad for the officers because this is traumatic for them, as it was the family, to sit there and watch her become very upset and sit in that garage with her hands covering her face. And when it comes to the mentally ill or it comes any time to use of force, I mean, it's traumatic for the family. It's traumatic for the people that witness it. And we sometimes get lost in the shuffle and forget it. It's traumatic for the men and women of this department that have to use that deadly force also.
I mean, describe that facing a mother who's lost her son. I mean, certainly this is when a police officer, or in your case, police chief, really has to call upon a sense of commiserating and empathy and go pretty deep into something that sort of transcends training, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, I have an obligation to train the officers on this department and to train them as best I can to use every feasible method not to have to use deadly force. In some instances, there's no other option. That's all there's going to be, we're going to be able to do. Verbal communication is some of the other issues or things that we have to work on as far as training is concerned. But again, I think sometimes we forget that somebody in law enforcement that has to pull that trigger, they need as much consoling and they need as much talking to as the family of someone that lost a loved one. Even if that loved one committed a crime, it is a traumatic experience on both sides of the table when an officer-involved shooting occurs.
We go to more callers. David, join us. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. So rumor has it that the police departments in general are not so good at white-collar crimes like identity theft. Is that true? I mean, what when it comes to those sorts of, you know, high-tech crimes or white-collar crimes involving, you know, I don't know, I think you understand what I'm asking. Do we go to the PD, or do we go somewhere else?
No, you still go to the PD, but it is true. I mean, in most departments across this country, there are some, when you talk about computer issues and white-collar crime and some of the crimes that involve some of the technology that we have today, there are some departments that don't do a very good job because of lack of resources or expertise. Our department, I'm trying to beef up some of the investigative entities that handle those components, but you are right. White-collar crime or some of the technological issues that come up today aren't being handled as well by law enforcement agencies across the country as opposed to maybe the FBI or an entity that has more personnel and they're trained more in the technological or the aspects of some of those. I do agree with what he's saying.
And I thank you for the call. There's also been criticism through the years that the police, of course, are tougher in terms of not only racially profiling, but that there are class differences. You know, used to be the argument that those who use crack cocaine did not get cracked down on as much as those who used the white powder who may be from bourgeois backgrounds or better suburban homes or that sort of thing. How do you see that?
To a certain extent, I mean, that's a valid issue or a valid argument that we could have another whole hour in discussion on that as to, you know, do we continue to arrest the dealer selling crack cocaine on the street, or do we go into some of the expensive clubs and expensive hotels where they're dealing cocaine in large quantities? That's the argument across the country. You know, we do the best job we can as far as crime suppression is concerned, but that is, like you said, I mean, we work on major cases as far as narcotics is concerned as much as we do on the street-level narcotics here in the city.
Here's a listener who says, on December 12, 2010, the SF Weekly did a cover story about errors and a cover-up of errors in DNA testing and homicide cases in San Francisco. What have you done to correct these problems, and do you plan to shut down the police lab and go to a private outsourced crime lab? Well, we should mention you're pretty new on the job here still. But
well, I can tell you that obviously I was over administration when the crime lab story broke, and then we identified there was an issue, and then we took affirmative action, and we're constantly auditing the crime lab. We're constantly going back to make sure that we don't have any more slip-ups. I do understand that some of the community question whether they can trust the crime lab, but I stay on the crime lab constantly to make sure the checks and balances are there. And quite frankly, so people have an understanding, narcotic testing, the contention that came up with the young lady that now does not work at the crime lab. We do not perform any narcotic testing at SFPD. That is all farmed out to a private lab.
Another listener says, can you please explain to me the often confusing sanctuary law in San Francisco? When was the statute enacted and by whom? How does it affect police operations? Does it allow more people to come willingly to talk to the police? And conversely, does it allow more criminals to fall through the cracks?
I can't get into the actual specifics of when the law was enacted, but I can tell you this. My posture on Sanctuary City is the San Francisco Police Department is not in the illegal immigration business. INS and ICE can deal with that. Our job is to keep this community safe. It doesn't make a difference to me where you're from, where you came from.
But INS likes you to work with them as best they can.
INS does, but people have to understand that when we arrest somebody and then place them in county custody, at that point, that's when ICE and INS come into play. We don't call INS people out to a location when someone says that they're here illegally, nor do we even ask them whether they are or not. I quite frankly don't care. My job is to keep everybody in the city safe. So I stay away from that in reference to we're just not in the illegal immigration business. That is for the state and federal government to handle.
We'll handle more of your calls. We'll go next to Ron. Morning.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Okay.
I'd like to thank the chief for his comments. They're excellent from the perspective of a peace officer. However, I'd like to add to the perception of the public as far as retirement system goes. The vast majority of line officers, when they retire, do not get $250,000, considerably less than that. You will find that some of the executive officers, chiefs, deputy chiefs in the larger agencies will fall into that category, yes, and mayors, et cetera. However, the line officer is not getting that. He's getting an average retirement. And it's up to 90% of his retirement if he does a complete 30 years.
And you're on what force, Ron?
I am a peace officer in the South Bay. I'm a union official, so I'm very very familiar with this issue.
Let me add on to what Ron is saying. One of the things I failed to mention is this. I find it kind of interesting that several years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, when the stock market was at the 14,000 level, when people were flying around in Gulf Airstream jets, when the stock was splitting and quadrupling and people were making tons of money and the dot-com era was out of control, there was no discussion about pensions. There was no discussion about how much a police officer made or a police officer took in retirement. It seems that to a certain extent, we in law enforcement and civil service and other entities have become the scapegoat now because the economy isn't doing as well as it did maybe 5 or 6 years
ago. We also had some scandals like in Bell, California.
Well, the Bell, California is completely out of control. I mean, that is just ridiculous. But you have people that come on a job as a law enforcement officer. They put their life on the line for 30, 33 years. They do a really good job, and they are afforded a pension. The pension system, the process has always been on the books. It's always been for public viewing. There are some instances where people act as if this is the first they've ever heard of it. This has not been a secret. We have not hidden the pension process. You can go on the internet to any law enforcement agency or any civil service job in the country and find out what they get paid in the pension. This has not been some secret process that we've been hiding for years and years and years, and all of a sudden we're giving up the information. It's been around a long time.
Well, it's the trajectory of boom to bust, isn't it?
That is correct.
We'll go to more of your calls. And let's go next to Suzanne, who's joining us from Marinda. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Chief. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about preparing to become a police officer. If you want to become a police officer and you don't have a high school diploma, is it better to get your GED or just go straight for a 2-year degree, maybe in criminal justice?
I think the 2-year degree in criminal justice would be the way to go. One of the problems you're going to run into is I came on the job in 1981, and in 1981, they were hiring law enforcement officers across the country at a huge rate. Now that obviously the economy isn't as well, you kind of have to pick and choose. I would still encourage people to put in their applications to the agencies in which they want to work in, and then once they get there, they can continue their education. But you've got to take your best shot. I know that SFPD right now is not hiring. We're going to probably bring in about 19 lateral officers sometime in April, but also have to go up on the website and see who's hiring and who's not hiring. In the old days, they'd hire 100 officers at a time. Sometimes they might only hire 2 or 3. So you've really got to stay on your toes and take advantage of some of those open positions.
You actively looking for recruiting women and minorities now in the police force here?
We always have.
So it continues?
It continues, yes.
We'll continue with more of your calls. We'll go next to Almut. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I had a question about, with there being so much technology in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, is the police department thinking or considering using technology as a means for people to pass anonymous tips or for the communities to be more involved in the activities of the police department, or technology for whatever purpose?
Yes, we are looking into some of the technology, the iPhones, to be able to have Twitter or some of the Facebook applications to be able to have people immediately send information to the department in reference to issues that are occurring. So, yeah, the technology is something that we're definitely looking into.
And thank you for the call. A bunch of questions by email. Let me try to go through them quickly with you, Chief. Here's Thomas, who says, please ask why the SFPD doesn't publish its police blotter. There's no way for the public to verify the crime statistics for San Francisco. This used to be public information. Why no longer?
We do publish the crime statistics. I will double check to make sure I'm not erring on this, but I know for a fact we publish the crime statistics up on the website, the numbers. I think maybe he's talking about the actual crime or the narrative in reference to the crimes.
You can read the short narratives in SF Weekly, I think.
Correct. And each of the captains in the 10 districts produce what is a community letter once a week that talks about crime trends and issues in reference to that.
Well, the listener says, and I've heard this complaint before, on the day of trash collection, my block is host to a small army of recycling poachers who go through each bin looking for cans and bottles. Is there a crime being committed here?
That's a good question. I'd have to look into that. I don't want to be quoted as saying yes or no, but I do understand that people try to recycle the materials so we can, you know, give back, obviously. The problem is that people will come into the recycling bins because they're going to take the property and turn around and try to take it to the recycling centers and get, you know, monetary value for it. So I'll look into that question.
Another listener says, Chief, it can take over a year for police applicants to get from the application to academy ready. During this time, good potential officers are siphoned off to other departments whose background departments move faster. Do you have a plan to address the speed with which SFPD processes applications?
Yeah, I can tell you that when I came on the job in 1981, it took about 90 days or 120 days to go from the time I put paper or pen to paper till I was in a police academy. In some instances now, it could take some people over a year to be able to get to the application process. And during that year, they still need to pay their bills and pay a mortgage. And it's difficult to try to hang on to that. So I want to try to expedite it as fast as we can. In some instances, depending on how many we have that are applying, how many positions we have, it can be a laborious process. But I do understand and appreciate their concerns that people need jobs and they want to get on the department. They don't want to have to wait a year and a half to do it.
One more question by email from Lee in Palo Alto. It says, what is the captain's, chief's opinion about smaller cities merging their police departments with those of nearby cities, along with sometimes making the police chief and fire chief one position? For example, all the cities of San Mateo County plus Palo Alto and Los Altos have a smaller total population than San Francisco by itself and occupy a smaller territory than that of many large cities. Merging might actually enhance the police's ability to provide advanced technical services such as crime labs and computer crime tracking.
I don't disagree with that. There are other agencies that combine resources such as fire and police together, and if it works for certain areas, I think that's a good thing. Have we entertained that thought here in San Francisco? No.
It doesn't seem like it would be very likely here in San Francisco.
No, I don't think it would.
What about new technology? How up are you on, and how up are the officers, particularly investigating officers?
I think the investigating officers as well as the officers in patrol, I think the interesting dynamics is that we obviously don't have the funding to get some of the technology that I would like to get. I think most of the young officers on this department today are much more versed. They probably have more technology at home at their disposal that they go home and use that we use on the police department, such as laptop computers. Up until about 6 months ago, I'm embarrassed to tell you that the officers on the SFPD, we didn't have email access to most of the officers where we could send email information back through the process. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's the reality of it, that we wouldn't, most of the officers, the command staff and certain select personnel had access to email through the department email system, but we're still trying to get all the officers on the department email access.
Let's go to another call. We'll access a caller named Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, this is Suzanne in San Francisco. My best wishes to you, Chief. I have a question regarding the mentally ill, and I want to include those who have Alzheimer's, too, who can be belligerent and hit others. Will it be your position to arrest and prosecute them or get people to the hospital?
My position is to get people to the hospital, and one of the things I want to make sure everybody understands about the police commission meeting tonight, one of my concerns is this. To be able to handle the mental illness problem in this city is going to take a lot of training, and I think everybody thinks that this 40-hour training that has become so public is going to stop us from being involved in officer-involved shootings, and that's not necessarily the case. There's got to be a two-pronged approach. There has to be resources for the mentally ill, and then there has to be more training for the officers. I think one of the interesting things that people forget is that when the men and women of the San Francisco Police Department put a set of handcuffs on somebody, that means the system has failed. We are the last point. When we have to arrest somebody because they're mentally ill, when we have to take somebody off the street because they have no place to live, there is a breakdown in local, state, and federal systems that need to assist us in that process. So I do agree with you. We just can't continue to take people to jail because they're mentally ill or they're homeless. The other social service entities have to step up and work in cooperation with the SFPD, which we do. But then again, we go right back to the budget issues that everybody's getting cut on their budget.
I thank the caller. Do you have to be more vigilant and more hardworking with respect to chain of evidence?
The police department?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, we've got to really do a better job of making sure the checks and balance systems are there, a constant audit process, which I constantly do. We put people in command positions that oversee certain entities, and the first thing I ask them to do is go audit their system to make sure that everything is up and running. You cannot expect unless you inspect. And that is one of the critical components in this department. And there is an audit process going through in most of the entities. And I'm telling my command staff, if you oversee an entity, you better go in and audit immediately, because you're responsible for anything that goes on within the confines of your command. And that's really important to me.
Looking for ways too, obviously.
Looking for ways, looking for better ways of doing it, things. Like I said, I can't afford to keep everybody in the Hall of Justice. I've got to put more bodies back in those black and white stamps or radio calls and do the things that need to be done. So we're looking to see how many people are working IT. We're looking at even how many people are working in the chief's office. Now, obviously, in an administrative position, you have to have people. If you don't have people in an administrative position, they're not going to be able to feed or support the patrol function. But we are looking to cut as much waste, so to speak, as we can and get as many bodies back in the field.
Let's bring another caller in. Warren, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad you take my call. Chief, I'd like to just come straight to the point. What can be done about the infighting between the homicide department making arrests and the district attorney not following through?
Well, it's funny that you mention that, Warren, because I've had candid conversations with the new district attorney telling them that I hope that they're going to start filing on these cases. I think sometimes politics plays a role in the district attorney's office as to whether they can win the case or not. My obligation is to investigate the homicide case, take it to the district attorney for filing, and then have it prosecuted through the system. And I think I do agree with you that I'm working closely with now DA Gascon and my investigators to make sure the cases that we take to the DA are extremely have been investigated quite well, and that we can get some filings and then some prosecution to get some of these people off the street forever that have committed these crimes.
May not be a whole new era, but frankly, one has to at least advisedly say that there was a good deal of enmity when Kamala Harris, despite her good intentions, and the police department, despite their good intentions, were going head-to-head.
Yeah, I think that going head-to-head would be a complete waste of energy, and we need to put that energy in more of a positive approach to handling the investigations as well as filing the cases. I think in a lot of instances, quite frankly, what the general public has to understand is we investigate homicides every day, and in some instances in homicides, we actually do know who the suspect who has committed the homicide, but we don't have any witnesses coming forward. We don't have any videotapes. We have nothing solid that's going to be able to connect that person in order to get a filing. So, and sometimes we identify suspects and we have to work that case for several months before we get someone that will come forward or some other piece of evidence that will allow us to have a rock-solid case that we can take to the district attorney's office.
We also have the problem of people not wanting to snitch or squeal and having that kind of ethos operating in so many communities.
Correct. That happens all the time. Sometimes you don't get cooperation. In some areas, when they hear gunfire, they just shut the window and they don't pay attention to it. If it's not their issue, they're not going to deal with it, and they're not going to witness it, and they're not going to be cooperative. So we do run into those.
You got your challenge of lifting fear in communities, too, and
correct,
building trust. I wish you good luck. Congratulations for being in this position, and thank you so much for joining us. Chief Jeff Godin with us for the hour here on Forum. Another hour coming your way, which will represent a pretty dramatic shift. We're going to talk about classical music and who the best composers are historically in the hour ahead. I hope you'll join us for that. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, and Christine Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.